Chapter 19. Niles excused himself, once again pulling the mic close to his mouth. He read the car spot as smoothly as if he had it memorized, then hit a button on the console, pushed the mic away, and poured himself another scotch. He fiddled around with a laptop keyboard, tapped the screen, grabbed the mic, and hit the talk switch.
Okay, folks, the teacher's changing the lesson plan. My apologies to Difford and Tilbrook for the interruption. We'll let Squeeze get back to pulling muscles a little later on. In the meantime, here's side one, when there was such a thing, of Terry Jester's classic album Minor Angels and Two-Eyed Jacks.
The DJ turned his attention back to Jesse. Terry Jester providing the background music.
Where were we, man?
Jesse said, the stuff of legends.
Right on. So after Jester's first album ran up the charts, he moved back to Boston and did all of his future recordings at Vagabond Sound on the Cape. Don't ask me why. Maybe he felt like the place was a good luck charm for him or something. Who the hell knows with musicians? His first two albums did great guns, and then he recorded this classic,
Roscoe said, pointing at the studio speakers.
But his fourth album was uninspired. His fifth was downright awful. Suddenly all the adulation, the comparisons to Dylan and Donovan vanished. Then so did he. Stopped touring, stopped recording, pretty much became a recluse. There were all sorts of rumors about his disappearance from the scene. Bad acid trips, a sailing accident, a smack OD, schizophrenia, a pilgrimage to India to study meditation with some nutty guru. One rumor, my personal favorite, is that he was a passenger in the car when Paul McCartney bought the ranch. Man, I miss those days. You could say anything, crazy things, and people believed it.
Jesse tapped his watch crystal. Sometime today, Roscoe. Remember, the stuff of legend.
My bad. Sorry, man. So, flash forward to 1974, and there are new rumors, only these are positive ones. Word is that Jester was back in the studio recording an album that was more mature, deeper, more intense and poetic than his old stuff. That it was gonna blow everybody's mind. By the next year, word had leaked from the record label people about the album's title,
The Hangman's Sonnet.
You should have been a detective,
wise ass.
According to my ex, my ass is the only part of me that ever had any brains. Otherwise, I would have been in a business where I made some real scratch.
So,
the deal was that the album was thematically based on a sonnet written in, like, 1882 in Wyoming or some such place by an anonymous guy who was about to be hanged for murdering the woman who done him wrong.
Sounds interesting.
Doesn't it, though?
I sense a butt coming on. Niles guzzled some scotch and laughed.
Funny, I think I'm one of a very few people who's ever heard it. Back when we were friends, Stan White invited me to the studio to hear the master before they turned it over to the record label.
Jesse was losing his patience,
but the master tape disappeared.
It's been my experience that things don't just disappear.
Okay, stolen then. Kind of beside the point, because one way or the other, that tape did an Elvis and left the building, and it's never been recovered.
I'm no expert, but why not remix the album from the other tapes?
There, my friend, is the rub.
Niles took a sip of his drink.
They didn't remix it, because there was only ever just one master tape. They brought the musicians for one day of rehearsals, and then recorded the album live on tape, 12 songs, straight through over 2 days. The only editing done was to be the countdowns and the banter between songs. The version I heard still had those things on it.
Jesse asked, but why not re-record it?
I guess part of the answer to that is the roster of musicians who played on the album. They were like an all-star who's who band of people who were admirers of Jester. People who had rearranged their schedules for this one-time deal. There's some argument about who was really there, but I'm pretty sure Stephen Stills and Glenn Campbell were on guitar, Booker T on the organ, Leon Russell on piano, Jim Keltner on drums, Charlie Daniels on the fiddle, Earl Scruggs on banjo, and get this, Paul McCartney on bass. The backup singers were James Taylor, Jackson Brown, Joni Mitchell, Judy Collins, Mavis Staples, and Linda Ronstadt. But here's the best part. None of them has ever admitted to taking part in the sessions. Very mysterious. Like they signed non-disclosure forms or something. Or maybe none of them has wanted to be associated with the musician's worst nightmare. Bad Karma and Mojo. But I suppose the better answer is that unlike the rumors in the 60s, Jester did actually go flip city when the tape walked out the door. He couldn't bring himself to remake the album, couldn't even get out of bed. I hear he was catatonic for a spell. When he came out of it, he went into total seclusion, and I do mean total. Greta Garbo had nothing on him. And the lawsuits! Roscoe threw up his hands. Everybody was suing everybody else. Jester, the recording studio, the recording label Jester, Jester, the recording company. It was a free-for-all. What happened? Niall shrugged. Who knows? History swallowed the details. But I guess some money's exchanged hands eventually, though the suits dragged on for years. In the end, no one came out happier or better for the experience. I do know that Vagabond's rep was shot, and they went belly up. Every 10 years or so, some music journalist or investigative reporter latches onto the story and rides it for what it's worth. There was a story in the Boston paper yesterday. So, is there anything else I can help you with, Jesse? Not that I don't love shooting the breeze with you, but I do have to do something here besides bending my elbow. Jesse stood and shook Roscoe's hand. Thanks for the time. Oh, one more thing, Roscoe. How much would that master tape be worth if it ever resurfaced?
Several million at least.
You know, there are probably Terry Jester fans out there who run tech companies, people who could drop a few mil without thinking about it. The DJ let go of Jesse's hand and hugged him.
Don't be such a stranger, man. Come down one weekend, and we'll tear it up.
Sure, Roscoe, he lied. As Jesse moved to the studio door, Roscoe called after him.
Do you miss her?
Every day. There was nothing else either man needed to say. Chapter 20. $845,000. That was the number running through King's head as he made his way to the meet with the man who had hired him to do the job in Paradise. $845,000, the price of a new Porsche 918 Spyder. He swore he could feel himself harden when he scrolled through photos on the net of the sleek, gunmetal gray beauty. Still, as much as he loved the car, there was no way he would blow all of his potential windfall on it. Besides, he didn't much care for paddle shifters. Paddle shifters were for wimps, the kind of guys who spent 90 grand on a Vette with an automatic transmission. King was a stick man all the way down to his DNA. You were one with the machine when driving a stick. When he drove on jobs, he always insisted on a stick. But even if the 918 came with a stick, King had other plans for his money. The blondes. He hadn't forgotten about the blondes. Blondes were way more available than stick shifts or spiders. Blondes of every size and shape and hourly rate. He downshifted the stolen red and white Mini as he got off Route 1 and onto US 93. He'd boosted the Mini from the Walmart parking lot, 3 blocks from the motel. In a few minutes, he'd be at the Whole Foods where the meet was to take place. King had made sure to set up the meet in a public place where he would be protected from ambush, but not one where the exchange of money would be noticed. It was also a store situated at the confluence of US 90 and 93. If he had to split in a hurry, he had lots of options. He could head into Southie on the streets, or backpedal to Route 9 if need be. It would make following him or setting a trap nearly impossible. He was proud of himself for that. On the other hand, he wasn't particularly proud of keeping Hump out of the loop. True, Hump was as dumb as a bag of hammers, but he was about the only friend King had anymore, and his time inside would have been much worse if Hump didn't have his back. Dumb as Hump was, he knew the rules of the game. Honor among thieves was a load of crap. And just like in the boxing ring, you had to protect yourself at all times. If Hump had forgotten how it worked, well, that was on him. King pulled into the lot. He was sure to be 10 minutes early, so he could check to see if he could spot anything that didn't fit or seemed to belong. But what the hell did he know about fitting or belonging? He'd been inside for so long, he always seemed to be out of place. The thought made him self-conscious about his clothes. A pair of ill-fitting second-hand store jeans, Payless running shoes, a Wham t-shirt, and an old navy hoodie. He took a deep breath, counted to 10, and got out of the car.
Once inside, he circled the store, stopping to pull jars and cans off the shelf, pretending to read the labels, dropping some in his handbasket. By the time he got to the produce department, he saw his employer was right where he was told to be, standing by the mangoes and pineapples. King liked mangoes. He loved the way they smelled so sweet and how slippery they were when the pieces slid down his throat. He watched his employer pick up three of the green and red fruits, prod them, hold them up to his nose, and put them back. "They're best when they're slightly soft to the touch and when they smell sweet," King said, walking up behind him. "But they shouldn't smell too sweet or give too much when you poke them." "They teach you that in the prison kitchen?" "We never got them inside. You got the money?" "Right here." His employer patted his jacket pocket. "Come on, let's shop a little." As they moved out of the produce section, King's employer said, "Did you find anything?" "First, I'm going to put my basket down, and then you're going to drop a can off the shelf. When you bend over to pick it up, drop the money in my basket. Then we'll talk." The employer sighed in disgust. "Who are you, James fucking Bond? Just do it." A minute later, there was a thick brown envelope in King's basket. They strolled some more. "Here," King handed a piece of folded white paper over to his employer. As the man unfolded the paper, he said, "And Jesus, did you have to kill the old broad?" "She croaked. We didn't kill her. Just look at the paper." "What's this?" "It's a photocopy of a safety deposit box key and the account number. Well, most of the account number. I took the trouble of blotting a few of the numbers out. Now, are you going to bitch about the old lady giving up the ghost?" The employer's eyes widened. "So what? For all I know, the old lady was keeping her pressed flowers in the box." "This has to hold what you're looking for. Truth is, we almost missed it. Tore the whole damned house apart, and I got lucky and looked a second time." "Okay, you've got your money. Hand it over." King snickered and shook his head. "No! What I got in the basket there is a small down payment. Maybe if I didn't know what was in the box, I would take the envelope and walk away. But the problem is, I know. And I got a pretty good idea of how much it's worth to you and how much it's worth to me."
"Oh, yeah? And how much is it worth to you?"
$1 million.
The employer laughed. "Get the fuck out of here."
"Nice try, boss. The thing is, if it's worth a lot to you, it'll be worth just as much to other buyers. Right now, you've got exclusive bidding rights. You walk out of this store without making a deal with me, and you're out of the bidding."
"Don't be stupid. You're in a box yourself. You're wanted for murder and assault. You don't know anyone in the business. You may have the goods, but you've got no juice, no contacts."
"Don't worry. I got all the contacts I need, and I got the key. The clock's ticking, boss. Tick-tock, tick-tock."
"Fuck you." King picked up his basket and walked away. His employer waited a beat to see if King would stop, but he didn't. He caught up to him in the parking lot. "I can't do $1 million. I swear on my mother's grave."
"Bullshit. I swear."
"Okay, then. $845,000, not a penny less."
"What the hell kind of number is that?"
"It's your magic number and mine. Deal?" "It's going to take me a day or two to get it together."
"Call me tomorrow and we'll set up the swap."
King smiled, shoving the envelope with the 10 grand in it into his pants.
"Okay, tomorrow. You try any slick stuff or try to squeeze me and I go find another buyer," King said, feeling now like he was the boss. "Understood?"
"I know when I'm beat. Call me." King got in the mini and split. He was in too much of a hurry to see his employer clap his hands together and look up to the skies.
Chapter 21. Hump was going stir-crazy in that motel room. Made sense. Being inside for half his life had trained him to hate confined spaces. But inside, you didn't have a choice about it, so you lived with it. You couldn't just slide the bars back or swing the cage door open and step out. There were 1 million rules governing everything you did inside, written and unwritten, official and unofficial, guard rules and prisoner rules. When to talk, when to wake up, when to sleep, when to do everything, who to look at in the eye, who your friends could be and who they could never be. Rules enough to choke an elephant.
The fact that he could open the motel door and leave if he wanted to made it all worse somehow. There was something about freedom that gnawed at his gut, always had. He didn't understand why. Hump had never been good with understanding the why of things. That was the reason he kept finding friends like King, inside and out of prison. Men who understood things and could explain them when he asked. What Hump never needed anybody to explain to him was how he felt, and he felt itchy in there. King had warned him about spending too much time outside the room until he got back with the money. He guessed he understood that. There was a chance, maybe, that the cops had gotten a line on them, as more than a day had passed since what they'd done in Paradise. At the same time, he didn't understand why King didn't say anything about him going to church yesterday. It was almost like King was happy to have him out of the room. Hump looked at himself in the mirror and shrugged. It wasn't like he didn't trust King. When you spend so much time locked up with someone else, alone time becomes special. People on the outside didn't understand that. Inside, the only things that really belong to you are in your head and heart. Truth was, Hump had liked his alone time, too. The first few hours with King gone felt good, but now it was wearing on him like a belt sander dragged across his face. The sound of the TV became a shrill and constant howl. Even after he turned it off, he could hear it in his head. He looked in the mirror, pinched his spare tire, slapped his belly, and made a disgusted face. His midsection used to be tight as a snare drum. That was something else being inside gave you. Time for crunches, sit-ups, push-ups, deadlifts, squats. Maybe he'd take some of his money and join a gym. He stepped away from the mirror, went to the window, pulled back the curtains, and made sure no one was coming. Even after that, when he saw he was as alone as he was ever likely to be, he looked over his shoulders just to make sure. Then, and only then, did he reach into his duffel bag, find the right pair of socks, and take out the dragonfly ring. King had made him promise before going into the old lady's house on Saturday that he wouldn't take anything out of the house except what they'd been paid to take. That was all part of the deal King had set up with the man who had hired them. "Remember, Hump, if we don't find what we come looking for, we don't take nothing. We're getting a nice payday for the work, so we can't afford to get caught fencing stuff."
"Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, ain't good enough. Promise me." "Geez, King, what am I, 5 freaking years old? What's with this promise me shit all of a sudden? We spent 5 years together, and I always had your back. Promise me." He promised, and he meant it when he said the words. But after the old lady kicked, he figured all bets were off. There was no guarantee they would get paid after that. Given the risks, the guy who'd hired them might just blow them off or disappear. And Hump figured he needed to get something out of it, especially if he was looking at manslaughter or murder, too. He knew people thought he was stupid. He guessed maybe he was, but he had an instinct for survival. Even insects and the dumbest animals had that, an instinct to survive. Hump ran his thumb over the stones on the dragonfly's wings. He liked the way the edges and facets of the gems felt against his skin. He held the ring up close to his eyes, moved it around so that the light made the red and green stones sparkle. But it was the 2 big diamonds that were the dragonfly's eyes, the way they seemed to make the light dance and break up like a rainbow that he loved most. He didn't know much about jewelry. He was mostly good at breaking things, at being muscle. But he knew something worth a lot of money when he saw it. And he was staring at something worth a lot of money. He'd found it in the old girl's bedroom, in a box under the bed that King must have missed. He liked thinking about how the old lady must have worn it when she was young. He liked thinking about the man who had loved her enough to shell out all that money it must have cost. He never loved nobody that much, and nobody ever loved him that much. Nobody ever loved him at all. He plopped himself onto the bed and thought about how much he could get for the ring. He tried sliding it onto his pinky, but he couldn't even get it over his nail. He laughed at himself for trying. He stopped laughing when he remembered the old lady was dead and the way she smelled before he cleaned her up and put her back in her bed. He put the ring in his pocket and wondered where King was. It felt like he'd been gone a really long time. Chapter 22. As trying as it was to see Roscoe Niles again because of his connection to both Jen and Diana, this was harder. He took a few deep breaths before turning his Explorer off the Concord Turnpike and into the parking lot. The lot belonged to the adjacent bowling alley, and Vinnie Morris ran his crew out of the place. Jesse and Vinnie went way back and had been connected through the late mob boss Gino Fish. Even before Fish's death, Vinnie had broken away from Gino to go out on his own, though he never stopped kicking a percentage upstairs to Gino out of love and respect for the old ways. Jesse asked for Vinnie at the front desk, and the kid played dumb.
"Vinnie who, mister? What'd you say his last name was again?"
Jesse shook his head. It was the same routine every time. "Do you guys have to learn a script?"
"What?"
"Look," Jesse said, showing the desk man his shield. "I'm chief of police in Paradise. I've known your boss since before you were out of third grade. Call back and tell him Jesse Stone is here to see him."
"Paradise, huh? I didn't think you'd need cops in Paradise."
"You'd be surprised, kid. I'll be at the bar." Jesse sat at the bar staring at the neat array of scotch and Irish whiskey bottles, but he ordered a club soda and lime. The bartender laughed.
"On the wagon, bud?"
"What is it today? I got a drunk sign over my head?"
"Come on, buddy. You kidding me or what? You're sitting here staring at them scotch bottles like you'd like to take them to a motel, and then you order club soda and lime? It's the dry drunk's favorite cocktail." He shrugged. "Am I wrong?"
Jesse didn't answer because he heard the sound of Vinnie Morris's handmade Italian shoes on the floor behind him. Vinnie was an impeccable dresser. Jesse imagined that Vinnie and Bella Lawton could blow a lot of money if they ever went shopping together. He doubted either of them had ever been to the outlets. The thought made him smile, but neither the thought nor the smile had a very long shelf life.
"Been a couple of months at least, Stone," Vinnie said.
"Uh-huh.
Joe, get the man a black label. I'll have one, too."
Jesse didn't put up a fight. They took their drinks over to one of the unused lanes way down away from any of the bowling. They sat on the plastic bench, clinked glasses, sipped. Both men faced the pins at the end of the lane, their eyes looking into the not-so-distant past. When Gino Fish was alive, Jesse and Vinnie had a kind of respect and admiration for each other's talents and toughness. But now they were bound together in darkness forever.
"Don't tell me you're here about that thing I did," Vinnie said. "That scumbag killed your girl. And even though he didn't pull the trigger exactly, he killed Gino. Nobody ever deserved killing more than that piece of shit. You saw what I did to him?"
"I didn't look at the pictures you brought me, Vinnie. I trust you. It's not why I'm here." Vinnie looked relieved.
"Good. So what brings you here? You come for chit-chat or to bowl?"
"A little chit-chat. Had a B&E in Paradise on Saturday. An old woman died while she was tied up, and the two guys who did it beat the crap out of a Mass Express delivery guy."
"Good, those Mass X fuckers never deliver my supplies when they're supposed to."
"Sorry about the old lady. But what's it got to do with me?" "Nothing. But I got two names or nicknames of the perps. I thought maybe you could ask around."
"Sure thing. What are the names?"
"King and Hump." Vinnie made a face.
"Hump?"
"Hump. That's what the Mass X guy said."
"Okay, I'll see what I can do. But Stone, you didn't come all the way down here just for this favor."
"I was visiting Roscoe Niles over at..."
"You know the teacher?"
Vinnie was impressed. "My ex introduced me to him years ago. We've been friends since."
"I love that guy. Always sounds half in a bag when he's on the air. So, what were you talking about?"
"You really interested?"
"Stone, you ever know me to ask questions or to say anything I don't mean?"
"We were talking about Terry Jester."
"Boston's Bob Dylan."
Vinnie was curious.
"What about him?"
"His manager's throwing him a big birthday party on Styles Island in a few weeks, and I wanted some sense of what I was in for. Then we got to talking about some missing recording." Vinnie laughed.
"He told you about the Hangman's Sonnet tape."
"Somehow, you don't strike me as a Terry Jester fan."
"I'm not, but I'm a big fan of money. That tape would be worth a lot of scroll to the person who finds it."
Vinnie rubbed his fingers together.
"When Gino was alive, he tried hard to get a line on that recording. He came up empty, and it wasn't only Gino. When there were all those lawsuits about the theft of the tape, somebody hired a PI I've crossed paths with to look into the whole thing. He came knocking on Gino's door. Gino told me that the cops used to come around asking him about it, too.
Jesse said, I guess a lot of people used to come knocking on Gino's door.
So how you doing?
Not like how it used to be out there, Stone.
How so?
Joe Braz was far from a saint, and Gino had his moments. But these foreign gangs have no respect. They'd just as soon shoot your grandma and your puppy as you, if it got them another square foot of territory.
Uh-huh. You watch out, Stone. See if I'm not right. These clowns are in Boston now, but they'll be in paradise, too. Maybe sooner than later.
Jesse and Vinny finished their drinks in silence. When they shook hands goodbye, they looked deep into each other's eyes. Neither spoke. Eventually, Jesse just turned and left.